to episode 49 of the Island CT podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast.
So we're recording on December 17th, 2017. Patrick has just updated our website today. Which, thank you very much. And this week we have a few science articles.
So the website first.
Okay.
I'll be a bit late somehow. So I use rsync to keep our website updated, and I moved some files at home, and I went to update it, and it took forever, and I didn't realize all of the podcasts were being re-uploaded. And then we got an email from GoDaddy saying, oh, by the way, you're exceeding your bandwidth. So I looked into it and stuff. It was my screw up. Anyway, we got a better system. I think I fixed everything. Mm-hmm. So the last podcast isn't up, but
okay,
I'm gonna put one up this week. Maybe one at the end of the week, and then this one will go off probably mm-hmm. around Christmas or right after Christmas. So, but maybe I'll get most of them up this week. I'll see. Okay. So that's the thing. rsync, I have to say, is a really good way of doing it because you have your own backups,
mm-hmm.
and you basically can use the same thing to back up your work to other places at home. And to right. upload your stuff. And I keep seeing people saying, oh, such and such provider is crap because I can't move my stuff. And, you know, unless you have some kind of strange database system. I mean, it's not strange, but some kind of complicated system. Just using actually a backup to upload your stuff to your server is just perfect. Because if you have any problems with them, who cares?
Right.
You've got
right.
your own copy. And
mm-hmm.
So that's really cool. Anyway.
Okay.
The other administrative thing is we've got a new microphone set up. It's the same microphone as before, and we'll see how it sounds. We're still
playing
with it. I did some tests a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
I got out all of our old microphones, like the big ones. And yeah. I think, I'm not certain, but I think the output impedance on them is totally different than normal ones.
Okay.
And I think that's why they're not registering on the computers.
Okay.
So there might be a way to get a little converter or build one and plug them in and have them work. Because they're supposed to be really good microphones in
right.
Mac 3.
Right.
So, it's, anyway.
It's a learning curve.
Yeah. And there wouldn't be any issues about the... any software issues with them.
Right.
Because it'd just be through the analog port.
So. Okay. No, that sounds like a good idea.
That's the only administrative stuff okay. I have.
So yeah. We have a few articles that mm-hmm. we're going to talk about this week.
Yep.
And then we have some serious building things that you got to, which is pretty
yep.
wonderful. Okay, would you like to start with your narwhals?
Okay, so this is the only article. This might be a bit shorter one,
mm-hmm.
This whole podcast.
Right.
I have just the one article. It is out of, let's see, it's out of the AAAS Science Journal, let's see, December 8th issue.
Mm-hmm.
On page 1328. So it's an original research piece. I don't think there's any perspective on it.
Okay.
And it's by Terry Williams and some other people. It looks like Terry Williams yeah, is the corresponding author. And she is from... Coastal Biology, let me see. Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, University of California, Santa Cruz.
Neat.
And Oh, there's someone from, one of the authors is from the University of Copenhagen. And those are the only two. No, Santa Barbara, California also. Greenwich Sciences? I don't know that. Anyway, so it's called Paradoxical Escape Responses by Narwhals, Monodon Monoceros. And basically, the premise of the article is that we know a lot about land animals and how they respond to being attacked or being stranded or whatever. And there's two main types. Fight or flight is one type, and that's the one most people know about.
That's the most commonly known one.
And that's governed by the sympathetic nervous system, which basically dumps adrenaline into the blood and increases heart rate and all your sympathetic nerves that dump noradrenaline in different places in your muscles, and they all get, I mean, on the vasculature in the muscles, they all get turned on, and you're ready for increased activity. And then the other one is the freeze response. And I faintly remember studying a bit of that when we were at St. Lawrence, and I think it's rabbits, and they get caught by a dog or wolf. They sometimes go just totally limp, and then just out of the blue, they'll just suddenly squirm and try to run away. And I don't know if that's what they mean by the freeze response. It sounds like it, but it's an interesting thing because the idea is the animal's carrying the rabbit for a while, the predator, and might get, if it feels no struggle, it might not hold as tightly as time goes by because it's
It
getting
takes
tired, it takes energy,
energy, right?
and
It's not
it seems like the
necessary,
animal's dead, right?
right?
But anyway, in this article, they describe specifically what the responses are in this freeze type response. And basically, it's governed by parasympathetic activation. So that's the vagus nerve and some other parasympathetic nerves. And you get slowing of the heart rate and breathing, and basically, you can't, the important thing for this article is that it doesn't seem possible to have both fight or flight and freeze response. And there might even be a brain center that controls the response to being attacked and it being able to turn on one or the other, in a way that, you know, it turns one on and shuts off the other. And that's normally what you think of when you don't even think about fight or flight. When you think activation of sympathetic versus parasympathetic systems, they tend to be to inhibit each other.
Which would make sense because they're at both ends of the
Exactly.
spectrum.
Exactly. And it's interesting to think, you know, it doesn't mean that you have across the board decreased blood flow when you're having a parasympathetic response, because you know after a meal you get a parasympathetic response, but you get an increased blood flow to all your digestive system and all that. So anyway, so we don't know as much about marine mammals, and they have an interesting situation because when they dive, they have their own special response, which is called the dive reflex, and that tends to involve decreased heart rate. And it makes sense because they won't be able to breathe. And what they found with the narwhal was there seems to be what they're calling this paradoxical response, where when they're trying to escape, they get both decreased heart rate and increased activity. So it's like on the one hand, they're getting this parasympathetic response that you get normally with freezing.
Right.
But you also get this increased activity.
That's what's...
For flight.
Yeah.
And...
Swimming faster, more exactly. quickly to escape.
And, yeah. and the premise was, well, marine mammals kind of have this dive response, so maybe they'll just naturally use the freeze response. But that's not the case, at least with narwhals. Mm-hmm. And what they did specifically, it was on the east coast of Greenland. There's some indigenous fishing going on, and they have very specific places where they go. And I don't know if they're allowed to do it all the time because of conservation. But anyway, the researchers went there, and when the indigenous peoples do their fishing, narwhals sometimes get caught in the nets, and they get stranded up on shore, and then they get released. Mm-hmm. And they took, I think it's 9 animals, don't remember, and they did measurements on them, and for 5 of them, they put on these trackers.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, and the trackers are only put on, it's close to the dorsal fin, and it's only with suction cups. Mm-hmm. And they stay on from just under half a day to sometimes up to 4 days, I think.
Is it like a Fitbit monitor for a narwhal?
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. So it has 2 parts. One mm-hmm. is an ECG.
Right.
And it has a few other measurements. I think... I'm not sure about the other measurements. But the second part is an accelerometer. Mm-hmm. So that it can tell how it's going, and mm-hmm. and stroke frequency, I think they're getting from the accelerometer.
Nice.
And after a while, it just falls off and then floats.
And they can collect it.
And they have VHF on it mm-hmm. and satellite.
No, they use ARDIF. No.
Well, for the VHF part, they probably
they have to.
So I suspect what happens is, I don't know how the satellite works. But anyway, so...
How cool.
Yeah, and so they have really interesting graphs and pictures. Figure 1, they actually show a narwhal with one of those devices attached. Mm-hmm. And then in part B, they show Greenland and the area where they did all this and some of the tracks.
You can see how it's just hanging out in some areas.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you would expect if it's in a pod of some sort or a good hunting area.
And so it's fun to look at those. The mm-hmm. the one to the right of that panel C and D are really fascinating. So the top one is what they call a post-escape dive, and the bottom one is an escape dive. A little bit backwards because, mm-hmm. so I couldn't find exactly how they defined the two, mm-hmm. but it seems like,
wow, they go deep.
They're one of the deepest diving animals, and we're going to get back to that mm-hmm. when we talk about the significance of this reaction.
Wow.
Because they have particularly adaptations that are maybe unique to narwhals. But anyway, the thing that's most fascinating with both of... So the escape dive, I think, is the first... So, okay, let's describe first exactly what happens. They get stranded mm-hmm. in these nets. They get released.
Right.
They swim out, and then they dive. Of course, they can't... So they're escaping. But they can't stay down forever.
Right.
So they come back up, and they're still in the escape mode. And then they dive again. And I think the first 5 dives are considered escape dives. Mm-hmm. And after that, they're post-escape dives. And then there's also, you can imagine, what are considered just normal, what they call transit dives, when they're going from one place to another.
Right.
but I'm not sure exactly this, what I said, those first 5 dives is exactly the definition. Anyway, in these figures, they show three things. They show the depth, and there's a blue line that shows that. They also show heart rate and stroke frequency. By that, they mean the tail fin stroke.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And the thing that's fascinating is the heart rate graph. Both the post-escape dive, right, which they're diving to about 250 meters in these two graphs.
Oh, yeah.
Both of them, the heart rate just plummets. I know. In the escape dive, it goes from, looks like about 73 beats per minute to below 10 in a single, from one measurement to the other.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm not sure what determines the frequency of measurements on mm-hmm. these graphs. It seems like sometimes
but
it doesn't get good ones.
But their beat ratio goes like incredibly fast. Dive in seconds. Yeah, that's really fast.
Yeah, it's in seconds. It's suddenly...
Yeah.
And
so within a minute, I don't think it's more than
less than a minute.
Yeah.
It's within like
3 or 4 seconds.
Maybe. It's like they get two beats, right?
Right.
And that's it. And the heart just almost stops. And they have a special name for this extremely low level. That's like below 4 beats per minute. And I can't remember what it is. I think they call it cardiac freeze.
Mm-hmm.
Let me look up. Cardiac freeze. Yeah, that's what they term it. Extreme bradycardia. And yeah, there's totally, I mean, they say in there that there's basically no relationship between stroke frequency for the fins and heart rate. And it's true. And they say that as for the escape dive, but even the post-escape dive. The post-escape dive has an interesting stroke frequency. It seems like they give a few strong strokes and then they just cruise to the bottom, and then slowly their stroke frequency goes up and their heart rate starts to come up a little bit also, and then they decide to just zoom to the surface, and the stroke frequency actually drops but the heart rate shoots up even slightly higher than when they started. And it kind of makes sense because you figure they're probably wanting to stay down as long as they can.
Right.
And so then they really need to take a breath and they're just shooting for the surface. In the escape dive, it's a little bit more complicated, but basically the heart rate stays down for over, I don't know, looks like over 10 minutes. They're diving at a shallower angle. But when they get there, their heart rate has been down the entire time. It hasn't started to creep up like it did in the post-escape dive. So, yeah, these animals are hurting for getting oxygen or getting blood flowing to their muscles. Lots of interesting graphs that show relationships between the heart rate and the time and how it goes up and down with their dives and then coming to the surface and diving again, and those extreme bradycardia episodes. Anyway.
That is really, a really cool article.
Really cool. Yeah, really cool article.
Mm-hmm.
So the significance of this is that usually narwhals, to escape predators, they'll do one of two things. They'll dive deep, and very few can dive as deep as they can.
Right.
So they're good there, like things like killer whales. Is
right.
One example. And the other one is they'll dive into shallow, or not dive, but they'll swim into shallow waters, supposedly. I didn't totally understand exactly what they were getting away from.
Well, it might be larger, like killer whale can.
Killer whales are probably a lot larger. Yeah.
They can't go in shallow waters. Yeah. Or as shallow water as they can.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's really neat.
What's what we don't know now is that, oh, well, the Arctic is losing its ice cover.
Right.
And part of the deep diving is going under the ice. Mm-hmm. And you know, the whole geography of the area is changing. Yeah. So we already know a lot about the problems the polar bears are facing. But there's going to be a lot of animals that face unique problems. And the narwhal might have problems with this adaptation that it has that may no longer be useful if the environment changes.
No, you're right.
Anyway, but the physiology is the most interesting part. Now, yeah. The change in the environment. That's what the article was about.
That is so neat.
Yep. So that was cool.
That is such... It's just fun to have that kind of data.
Let me see. Some of the interesting specs during what they call the ascent phase of the escape, they're doing almost 41 strokes per minute. So they're really... beating fast. This is like for their fins, right? Mm-hmm. Not the beat. And post-escape dives 37 strokes per minute.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the fastest on average for a routine 15-meter dive, which is normal as opposed to this. I have to look at it every time. Yeah, no, it really is down to 250 meters. That's insane.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
So,
but routine ones, just 15 meters.
Wow.
And their stroke frequency is about 19 strokes per minute. So, you know, they're hanging out.
Yeah, definitely. I looked up some just general facts about the narwhal because I'm like, I can't even figure out how big these animals are. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a good idea. So they range in size from 3.95 meters to 5.5 meters. These are a nice size mammal. And their mass goes from 800 to 1,600 kilograms.
Yeah, that is huge. That's huge.
I had no
idea.
Well,
they live in the Arctic, right?
Right.
So they've got to have tons of blubber, especially for a smaller animal.
Right. Because that will give them...
Do you know, if I'm not certain I remember this correctly, but I think that their long tusk or whatever is actually a tooth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I've heard.
That's what you've heard as well. Yeah. It's a modified tooth.
Right.
As opposed to like antlers on a deer or whatnot.
And they have dives that last for 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Anyway, I just thought a few facts because looking at the article, it made me just interested in, okay, hold it. Let's just check some general information.
Monodon monoceros. I wonder, it sounds like there's only a single species.
Yeah.
Which would be unusual for a marine mammal of a particular type. Usually there's several related species. Like, you know, the one that I'm always amazed about is when I first heard about, I mean, years and years ago, about river dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were in college, and then realizing there's like a different species in practically every river, major river in the world.
Exactly.
The Mekong has them. I mean, that's not a humongous river compared to some of the others that we usually think of, like the Amazon and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're kind of like all over the place. So that was my article.
Okay.
We haven't had... we've been pretty busy as usual.
Yeah.
So we haven't had... time to look over each other's articles. Were you wanting to do one?
I will do a really short one. It's called Why Aging Attenuates Antiviral Responses. So it caught my attention because I always wonder, why does the flu affect the elderly more than the rest of the population?
Something you sent me?
So this one is just from Science News from December 15th.
Why Aging.
Yeah.
Got it.
And it was interesting. They went into it and they realized that the interferon There's less
interferon.
Interferon. And the interferon shows reduced induction of antiviral gene. So what they thought is that because of this impaired signaling of systolic RNA, sensor, the RIG1, it actually, because that's impaired, it's actually part of the effect of the flu virus impacting them more than the rest of the population.
It kind of makes sense. So the way I remember interferon, I mean, I haven't said that in years, but the cells produce it, and they produce so if a cell gets attacked by a virus, it can sense it's got a virus growing inside of it.
Right.
And it, if I remember correctly, it produces interferon, and it kind of knows it's going to die.
Right.
To speak teleologically. And the interferon gets secreted outside, and it's kind of its last gasp. And it's a message to the cells around it. Just watch out. And there's receptors for the interferon. And cells that sense interferon out there therefore know another cell has been attacked by a virus really close by.
Right.
And so they shut down, if I remember correctly, they shut down a lot of transcription, which means that when the virus injects itself, its DNA or RNA into the host cell, it can't transcribe.
Right.
And then it gets degraded before there's, and then the cell is able to go on. And there was a long time ago some ideas like, wow, we've discovered this great thing. We're going to create these interferon cocktails and inject them into people, and then they'll be protected from virus attacks. And yeah, great idea that didn't work. I can't remember why, but.
So one of the things they're thinking about is restoring the RIG1 signaling in elderly patients to see if it impacts it.
Yeah, so this, it's an impaired RIG1, and RIG1 is an RNA sensor.
Yeah. So I just think that it's kind of cool. It'll be interesting to see what comes of it.
I wonder what if RIG1 is actually a viral RNA sensor.
Yeah,
because that
sure.
could be the signal.
It might be
for making the secreting interferon.
You're right. That could be, but again, it was just a short news, and so I didn't have a lot of other information. So this article came out of News just this week on Friday, and Science News. And I expect there's an article coming in the next issue of Science. It is really cool. I want to see their data.
Is this the RNA or the next article?
This is the next article. It's called Fracking Linked to Low-Weight Babies. So basically, there's been a lot of fracking going on in Pennsylvania. A lot of concerns with health risks. There's a few states like, I know New York State and Massachusetts has banned fracking in their states. Although the evidence that they have, or the evidence against fracking has not been specific to the location that fracking has been occurring. So it's difficult to use as, oh, and fracking is causing this.
You wrote down low sample sizes right here. And, you know, that's one of the main things, that low sample sizes almost guarantee that whatever you want to make of the data, you can.
Right.
Because it's, the noise is so high, and you can be like, well, it doesn't mean anything. You can be like, look at this little thing here that shows that this is a creep. Yeah, that's a problem.
So I was just interested, and I have to say, as I read about it, I was just curious, because my concern is always with our drinking water, and I've heard a lot of concerns around fracking with hydrology and and water safety afterwards. So I was interested in that part, so that's what attracted me to the article. So when I went back to this, I was curious, well, how did they get around this low sample size? So exciting. It reminded me of a traditional paper done by John Snow, Dr. John Snow. Don't you remember the cholera one that you learn in school? And he broke the pipe, he broke the water well in a location to stop cholera from being transmitted around a small location in London. And this study, they had like a similar way of looking at the data, which I love. Cool. So basically, Janet Carey and her colleagues out of Princeton University, what they did is they collected data of infants, 1.1 million infants born between the age, born between 2004 and 2013. And during that period in Pennsylvania, there's been, during that period, there's been 10,000
wells,
new wells made. Okay. So it went, there's been thousands of wells and there are now currently more than 10,000 wells.
Got it.
Okay. Pardon me for that miscommunication. So what they did is they took, the researchers overlaid data maps showing where the wells were occurring and birth weights of the babies. And isn't this cool? Because it's like such a simple idea.
But it makes me think, actually, there's a piece of data that would be really nice to have.
Yeah.
Where are they dumping the water?
Yes.
Right? Because I don't remember that we've talked about this, but it seems like the real bad thing is not as much the fracking,
but the wastewater. The chemicals that they put down to get to the... Yeah. To the gas, the natural gas.
And what they do with the water afterwards.
And what they do with the water
afterwards. Mostly gets pumped into the ground, but not necessarily in the place where they did the fracking.
Right. Yeah. So, anyway, it makes you really interested in the practices that are being used by companies. So what they found is infants born within 1 kilometer of the wells were 25% more likely to have low birth rates. That means less than 2,500 grams or 5.5 pounds. So
That's one group of data. Like to see graphs.
Yeah. Well,
like from distance and stuff. Is it?
So I think it's about to come out, Pat. I think
they
usually do this little news brief on it in Science, and then the next month we get all the data.
Get the paper.
So I'm looking forward to seeing their data in the next issue of Science, and it'll probably be coming out in January.
2.5 kilograms. That's a lot, isn't it?
So, no.
I mean, that's a lot. That's a small baby.
That's a small baby.
That's like, is that that's, very small?
Yeah, that is. You remember Alana when she was born? We held her in our hand.
Yeah.
That was Alana. Babies are usually twice kilogram? That size. Like, you know, for their... Yeah. Not twice, but they have a lot more weight than that. Good weight of a baby. I guess I should look that up before I just spew out what I think. So I'll have to check that.
How heavy were Isaac and Luke?
Luke was 8.6. Isaac was 712.
Pounds.
Which means three.
Yeah, well, they said, 2,500 is 5.5 kilograms. So, that's, wow.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'm looking forward to learning more about that.
Interesting.
Study.
Smaller and less healthy. Mm-hmm. I wonder if less healthy, when they give us more information, if it's just indistinguishable from low birth rate problems, or if there's some specific stuff that's the identify with fracking
like specific.
I mean, the interesting thing would be to find something that is not associated with low birth rate, but that has a higher incidence.
Right. So. Yeah. Anyway, very interested in reading more about that. But that's all I have. And I love that the article could be compared to my cholera article that I'll probably be talking about in the next 2 weeks.
It's from London.
Yep. Yep. So it's John Snow.
John Snow.
And it's one of those water quality articles that we talk about with kids because there's a simple solution to it. It's a contaminated well.
Yeah.
And it's being contaminated by human waste. And neat study.
Up to me?
Yep. Up to you.
So this is partially about technology.
Yes.
And I got a new camera for my birthday.
Ooh.
Thank you. So, haven't used it yet, but it charged up. It's an Olympus TG5, and it looks like it is a nice camera and nice and rugged. So I have nothing to say about it yet, but stay tuned for a tech report, a review of this camera, because the last one that I've been using
was not rugged.
Well, no, it's really rugged, and it's super waterproof. The problem is that everything comes out blurry, and I've tried to find different settings, and it just doesn't.
I know. It's really, so, Patrick and I have been taking a lot more pictures. We have as a family. Yeah. Whenever we go out, we have cameras that we're always taking pictures. We had a Fitbit, or not a Fitbit, a Flip.
Flipvid, that was cool.
A Flipvid, which we loved. And then they stopped producing them. And they were just the perfect size. And we just thought they were fantastic for rock climbing and hiking and being compact. And I guess
and
they
cheap
were
cheap enough that you could be rough with it and be like, whatever.
Yeah. You know? And I guess today it's been replaced with phones more.
Yeah.
And since we never got into the cell phone. Yeah.
The problem with the phone is the problem with everything else. You turn it on, you fiddle with it. The Flipvid, you took out, on, press the button. It's gone, right?
Yeah, it was perfect.
That's what you need, not something that you're going to have to fiddle with every time.
Right.
For us, we actually, you know, you're into the activity, not into taking the video.
Right.
So
and also, with the phones, the resolution is never as clear as what you can get with a camera. Yeah. Or, camera.
The Flipvid, I don't think the resolution was... I mean, there's probably pretty
good. It was an excellent, but it was awesome.
Yeah. That's right.
We even liked it better than the GoPro, which we tried to upgrade to, thinking we would love that, but...
The GoPro had a different use case.
It did.
It's much better for things where you have to do the action and take the video yourself.
Right.
And it's going to be a first-person type of view that the person is going to see in the video rather than... I mean, it's always kind of that way, but yeah, it's when you have to have your hands free.
Mm-hmm.
You can't look at what you're taking videos of because you're doing stuff. So you have that... I don't know if it's a total fisheye, but it's got this weird shape that makes it that you can be slightly off. And you're still getting good shots.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, of course, is everything looks really small.
It does.
So,
Anyway. But we're so excited to use it.
Some technology stuff.
Mm-hmm. So,
more.
How about your boards?
You want me to talk about the boards?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I will move this down. I hope this doesn't. The new microphone setup is hooked to the computer, so. Might be catching my
typing.
Anyway, so I don't think I had gotten the RF boards totally working, the audio frequency / RF. Maybe I had last time already. I think I had. Anyway, I've been working every night and as much as I could last weekend at getting the Oshpark version of that made. And yesterday I finally exported the Gerbers, and I think I'll try to check it over one more time today, and we'll send them off. So they should be arriving in January, unless I find a mistake.
Woohoo! Yeah. That'll be fun.
We'll see. I still have to design controllers for them, but that's not as big a deal. And like a huge amount of testing has been going on, and we got new materials for making the antennas, and so that's all fun. One big thing is moving to KiCad 4. I mean, I think this might be my first KiCad 4 project from KiCad 3. Mm-hmm. And the library setup is, I can't remember, maybe the Foxering tiny little boards I did real quick on there. But the library format in KiCad 4 for the modules, which is basically, so KiCad first is design software.
Right.
You make your schematics for your electronic circuits on there, and then you make what's called the layout, which is how you want to put the pieces on your board, and then you export these file called Gerber files to a place like Oshpark, and they make them for you and mail them. The modules are what other people in other software calls footprints. They're basically the shapes of the pieces you're going to put on, and you need to know those. And KiCad 4 has a new format, and it's been a real pain to move to it, like any major change, but I have to say I like it a lot more.
Oh, nice.
There's one file per module, and you just, if you want to change the module, you can use KiCad to change it, but you can take out a module, put it in by simply moving the file. And when it's all one database, you know, there's a huge learning curve because you're trying to learn the format of the individual files and the format of the modules within the file and how the database. With each one being its own file and it's just drag and drop, you can go into a file and be like, right, this is what a module definition is. And it's pretty clear. It's actually mm-hmm. not that complicated. And so it allows for average people to really get into it and tweak things and see if something's wrong by looking into the file. And I quickly wrote a Python script that actually makes the file for me, given particular parameters that I can put it in a different format, and just kind of a proof that I understood it. And so that's really mm-hmm. cool. Anyway, so that's KiCad 4. And I only have one other thing. Do you have anything? It's more biological.
No, I don't.
So we used to have a plant in Luke's room, call it mm-hmm. Luke's plant. We got it, and then we moved it outside mm-hmm. when it got cold, or before it got cold. It got aphids on it.
Yeah.
And I started to search up what eats aphids, and ladybugs is one of them. And
yeah,
it got cold. We brought the plant back in his room, and at the same time, we got a huge swarm of ladybugs. It seems
right
out by the garage.
A bumper crop this year.
I know, and they were all coming in, and mm-hmm. and I think I have like several hundred that died in there.
Yeah,
and I was rescuing them and putting them on Luke's plant. Yeah.
So we're Luke's probably plant, the only people that have done that, but
well, so Luke's plant is in the bedroom. Is in
that aren't
Luke's
doing
room.
Serious research on yeah. ladybugs.
And I searched for ladybug food, and of course, you search for aphids, and you get how to kill them. But I found out some interesting stuff, and anyway, just to keep it short, because we should be wrapping up soon, but I've tried both cutting open oranges. I mean, so they're carnivorous, right? They mm-hmm. eat aphids and stuff, but they'll also actually eat anything that's fruitier or whatnot.
Yeah.
And they've been liking both the orange, cut open orange, and the apple, especially the apple. They really like the apple.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why. And we have like a whole little, so now it's too cold outside. There's no more ladybugs outside, but in Luke's room,
inside.
We've got a little community, and they used to be going all over the room. That's something that's known about.
They probably eat the rafters as well.
Do you see? Well, they're starting to hang out mostly on the plant now. So people know that if you're releasing them for pest control, you have to keep releasing them because they fly away.
Right.
But
maybe they aren't putting enough fruit out around their plants. Maybe they're not
putting enough fruit. Yeah. So mostly now they're staying around the plant. And like we have a whole little community. Found two copulating the other day. Or it looked more like one was trying to copulate it with another one that wasn't so interested. I don't know. Found one with its head missing. So I think either they got carnivorous or we have some other plant. Or, I mean, some other insects that...
That are feeding on them as
that,
well.
That went to feed on that particular one anyway.
Or the local rodent that's also come in to feed on them.
Except it'd be hard for a rodent to eat just the head of a...
I'm teasing. Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, so it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah.
How long they can stay and whether that gets maintained. I think I have... If I go in there and look for them... I can usually see 5 or 6.
Yeah.
But I think I might have 8 or 9 in that room.
That's cool.
And they do fly around. You see them on the walls and stuff. But they've been spending more time lately on the plant.
Yeah. Nice.
Anyway.
Well.
Future plans. So we haven't talked about education. There's nothing much now. No art of season.
Right? And...
Christmas is coming up.
Yep.
And we have some fun gifts, but I'm not going to... We're not going to say anything because just in case someone listened to the podcast before Christmas, but we're going to have some fun techie stuff to talk about. Yeah. That'll be cool.
Yeah, so we can test some stuff out.
And then Canaan Valley.
Canaan Valley, yeah.
Where they already have snow.
Yeah.
So,
woohoo! Hopefully we have some skiing.
Yeah.
Well,
that pretty much it? Okay. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure and check out our blog.
Which I haven't updated, but the website is on its way. It will.
Aniva! Yeah.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.